Welcome, everyone. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and it's good to have you with us, as always. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Well, we've had another terrorist attack, this time in Brussels. Two separate locations were targeted this time, one at the departure hall at Brussels Airport. Two explosions, at least one caused by a suicide attack, killed around 10 people just before 8 a.m. local time, or around 3 a.m. Eastern time. About an hour later, an explosion at the Molbeek subway station in central Brussels, not too far from the European Union's core institutions, killed about 20 people. More than 230 have been wounded at this point. We really don't know yet all the details. About 8 hours after the explosions, a news agency affiliated with the Islamic State issued a bulletin claiming responsibility, calling Belgium a country participating in the coalition against the Islamic State. And officials noted that the time of the attacks on Tuesday was just days after the arrest of Salah Abdeslam, the main surviving suspect in the assault in and around Paris last year that killed 130 people. So it's more than likely that this is a response to that arrest. But we have with us, ladies and gentlemen, on the line, Matt Bracken, to talk more about this and also Islam in general, about the threat to Europe and what we're facing now in 2016. Matt is the author of Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, and a well-known advocate for the Second Amendment. He is a former Navy SEAL as well. Now, we might not agree on revisionism or what happened in Germany in the 1930s. I think the comparison of that time with what's happening in Europe today are two completely different things, and the former would never approve of our countries being overrun by the latter. If you're a regular listener, you know that we've covered a lot on the show that refutes the official version of what we're told about this period. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to discuss the problem of Islam in the West and what just has happened in Belgium, Brussels, and what this will lead to later this year and future years. I think some really important points are made here that will be good for you to hear more about. His website is enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. Welcome, Matt. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be on.
Well, you wrote a very interesting piece on, it was published on Gates of Vienna. It was called Tet Take Two, Islam's 2016 European Offensive. And it just happens to be that we actually timed this in just on the day when this occurred, which is, of course, on the very topic that we're going to talk about. We just really propose or suggests that this is something that is now so recurring that we would just get a direct hit, if you will, of something like this in terms of timing.
Right, exactly. It's like seeing who has the same birthday in a large group at a party. you know, you're bound to have some coincidence. But as we see, these are going to increase in frequency until they're a weekly event. And then, you know, it won't even be noteworthy. It will just be in the background. Like, meanwhile, in Budapest today, you know, 80 died. Like, when we hear about it in Baghdad, or if we hear about it in Mosul, we don't stop in our day. You know, well, the same people are bringing the same practices and customs. I mentioned in my TET article, there's even a name for this in the Middle East. We have to learn this name. It's called Hama rules, and like with the regulations of a game or the law of a game. Hama is a city in Syria, not far from Damascus. It was the big hotbed of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 80s when they were fighting against the president of Syria's father and not the older Assad. And they kept sending car bombs out of this town of Hama and using it as a sanctuary. They were Muslim Brotherhood. That's what they called them then. It's the same crowd. It's the same gang. And eventually, in order to stop this, they had to just go in like Stalingrad with tanks and artillery and practically level Hama, and up to 20,000 were killed. Now, depending on who you listen to, this is a great atrocity, you know, proof that the senior Assad was a butcher and a barbarian like a Saddam Hussein. But what do you do if you have a town of 50,000 and every day bombs are coming out of it?
Right, exactly.
Well, this is going to come to Europe, my friend. No, this is unavoidable now because, you know, Molenbeek in Brussels is nothing more than a Hama that's just a few kilometers from the, you know, European Parliament. They have allowed a Hama to migrate right into the heart of the EU, which is so telling. It's like the two evil hearts of Europe. You know, the evil heart of the EUSSR, the USSR, and the evil heart of the Islamic terror network are both a few blocks from each other. So now they
it's remarkable.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And these Inspector Clouseaus, I don't know if the Peter Sellers movies were popular.
Oh, yeah, I've seen
them. Yeah, but these Inspector Clouseaus can't find these guys, and they're living in the same place they've been searching over and over and over again. Every time they go in there, everybody says, no, we have no idea where those guys are. Nothing like that, because we're just good, moderate Muslims. If we knew, we would tell you, believe me.
Well, you know, that's actually a really good point. You know, a month before the Paris terrorist attacks, the mayor of Molenbeek, Francois Schepmans, I think her name is, and a Brussels district, you know, long notorious of actually being a haven for jihadists, she received a list with the names and the addresses of more than 80 people that were suspect as an Islamic as Islamic militants living there in her area. And the list, based on information from Belgium's security apparatus, included two brothers who would take part in the bloodshed in France on November 13 in Paris, as well as the man suspect of being the architect, if you will, of the terrorist plots. And she had allegedly said, Schepmans, what was I supposed to do about them? It's not my job to track possible terrorists. And I think this is really also a indication of what state Belgium in itself is. It's a fairly recent nation. It's kind of a hodgepodge of French, Dutch, and German speakers. Of course, you do have the Flemish portion of this, which really is, in terms of nationalist, you know, angle to it, where things are more on a national and cultural level than any of the other regions in it. And they all seem to kind of blame each other, and no one is really taking responsibility. And now this is the result, right? Not only the European Union, but also the fact that the enemy of Europe is in the same, you know, capital. It's just amazing, isn't it?
If Hollywood or studios in Europe are going to make another Inspector Clouseau film, you know, find somebody like a Peter Sellers, they would definitely do it in Brussels, because Belgium is the most, you know, split apart, neurotic, schizophrenia, you know, split personality even. And this is the heart of the unified Europe. In this schizophrenic split, you have a city with what, like 5 different mayors or 10 different mayors of each district. You know, nobody, the trains run into the trains from one end to the other because they refuse to speak the other language. You know, so the train engineers have literally had collisions because they will not speak anyway. And this is supposed to be the heart of unified Europe. So no wonder in this land of Inspector Clouseau's, where you have 80 people, if they are put under watch, or even just, how about if they just are detained for suspicion? Suspicion of what? Suspicion of being a loiterer. Suspicion of loitering. When this is an existential crisis coming for Europe, it is as dangerous as the Nazis with tanks and Stuka dive bombers. It's just as dangerous, but it's by infiltration method instead of blitzkrieg method. But it's just as existential when you are going to have a Hama, which eventually will have to be attacked like Stalingrad, and you allow them to incubate and grow inside of your own capitals. History is going to consider this to be completely mad.
Well, mad. You know, unlike the National Socialists in Germany, the rest of the world practically turned on them. In this case, we have our own leaders defending these people. They're letting them in through into our heartlands. They are now behind enemy lines, so to speak.
They're clearly collaborators, and people need to understand how these trends play out. This is nothing new. This has been happening for 1,400 years. Sometimes the jihad is by a massive sea invasion, like from Morocco to Spain, using the Berbers as the new energy base. The Berbers of Morocco, when they had the fanaticism of the new converts, that's when they sprang into Spain, these energetic new Muslim Berbers. But today, you know, you have, so other times, you know, they have done it much more stealthily, just demographically, the Hijra invasion. And a Hijra in jihad is considered just as legitimate a means to get into paradise as a violent war jihad. If you die on Hijra jihad, for example, anybody who dies in the raft, and this is why it's important, if they die in the rubber boat just going from Anatolia, Turkey to Leros or Lesbos, if they drown, they go straight to heaven and get the 72 virgins, the same as if they blew themselves up. This
really?
Is one of the reasons they're so motivated to do hijrah.
Which is like holy migration, right? For those who don't know, the hijrah.
It's a holy migration. And if they drown and their goal, their intention was to migrate to Germany and convert it to Islam, if that was their intention, they get the same reward as the guys that blew themselves up in the airport and the subway, the metro, because they died on a form on jihad. And it's, you know, this is Quranically based and this is what they're taught. This is why they're very eager to get into dangerous situations with overcrowded rafts. If they make it, great, I'm going to Germany. If I don't make it, I get straight to heaven.
Yeah, and at the end of it, there might be free stuff for you as well, right? So there's up and, you know, it's all pluses for them.
Right, and there's, I saw a video yesterday. It showed some guys that are just waiting in Anatolia because there's some holdup on the refugees for bad weather and political reasons, the EU bribery money, the blackmail, you know, to Erdogan. But these migrants are saying, there's nothing for us here. Well, they look healthy to me. They're wearing nice clothes. They said, there's nothing for me here. What they mean is, I get welfare money in Germany. The Turks won't pay me to sit here. The Germans will pay me to sit here.
Yeah. No.
Or Sweden, of course.
But well, exactly. There's a lot of countries here that they do want to come to. And you know, in terms of refugees, we've gone through this before on the show, but they're passing through a lot of peaceful nations that
right.
I think by law was by law, but you know, they're supposed to take care of them. You're supposed to go to the nearest country, right? But even their neighboring Gulf states are not letting them in for some reason, right?
But no matter how they get in, whether it's a mass invasion, you know, on horseback with scimitar swords, or if it's a hijra refugee invasion pretending to be refugees, I mean, they have enough men coming into Europe to form an army and defeat anybody in the Middle East. You have 1 million men between the age of, you know, a teenager and 40 years old coming into Europe in 1 year. That's a 1 million-man army. That's many more than ISIS.
Yeah, definitely.
More than ISIS. If they have motivation to wipe out ISIS, they can do it. But they have motivation for hijra, and they're using the camouflage and the subterfuge of a refugee crisis. And the worst part, my anger is not so great at these Muslim invaders. I consider them in the way I would consider hyenas or jackals. You know, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. This is how they've been trained from watching lambs slaughtered as like their big holiday. Come on, children, we're going to cut the lamb's head off in the most bloody, gory way and have a party around it. So it's not surprising that they enjoy blowing things up and beheading. It's how they're raised. But the European traitors, these socialists, you know, these globalists, they want everybody to be under one form of socialism. You know, we look at the history of communism and socialism in the 20th century, and we say, well, it failed. It's proven it failed everywhere. It failed. Mm-hmm. Look at North Korea, Cuba. But the committed socialists say it failed because we let those capitalist countries survive. And it always upsets and distorts the future socialist one world economy if you have these free enterprise capitalist zones where people can escape from Cuba to get to America. What we have to do, their lesson from communism of the 20th century, is we have to make sure the whole world gets under a socialist banner and there's nowhere to migrate to where the smart, hardworking people will escape across an ocean or any place because everywhere will be socialist. Well, they are so evil, these socialists. They're just as evil as Stalin and Lenin and the rest of them. They are using this Muslim invasion as a murder weapon against their own nations.
Yeah, that's right.
German traitors and Swedish traitors are so dedicated to the goal of putting a red banner over the entire planet that they are allowing an influx, a demographic bomb that is going to overcome Sweden and make it Islamic. These traitors don't care as long as it's socialist. And they are both totalitarian forms of government where, you know, the basically the mafia that runs the place can make any rules. They can make harem rules for the girls. They can make special nomenclatura hard currency club stores just for the elites in a socialist country where, you know, the party bosses still live like Rockefellers and like the czars. So these evil people that like, you know, the largest, most controlling forms of socialism and Islamism, the people that run it get to live like sultans. Whether it's, you know, whether it's in the Soviet Union where the party comrades at the top had their dachas on private, you know, lakes with mansions for dachas.
Yep.
And special stores and special hospitals just for the party top elites, and everybody else waited in line for soup and for, you know, for a bar of soap. Well, the people at the top don't give a damn whether the slaves at the bottom are Muslim slaves or factory slaves. And
this is gonna bankrupt our countries. It's gonna not only in the sense of trying to keep security and
but that's
and,
all
know,
part
safe.
Of the plan. That's all mm-hmm. part of the operation. This is what the Jacobins called out of order chaos. We have to, out of chaos order.
Right.
It sounds better in German. Or anyway, you have to create the revolutionary situation. There's no revolutionary struggle in a happy country with full stomachs and stores full of bread. You have to make bread riots. You know, you have to make bread dear and scarce and expensive in order to have bread riots. The way that Lenin put it, or it's attributed to Lenin, the worse, the better. And in America, the Black Panthers said, burn, baby, burn. You have to bring it all down. You have to destroy it and then rebuild from the rubble. So the fact that they're going to bankrupt your country is of no concern to them. They want it bankrupted. When everybody is hungry and tearing apart at each other, then only a dictator can set the rules for distributing food and water. That's what Lenin said, the worse, the better. So don't mm-hmm. worry that they, how can we understand our politicians? Don't they understand they are bankrupting our country? They'll never admit it. Of course they're bankrupting the country. This is a tactic.
It's a big gamble they're doing here, though, because obviously what is developing here in Europe is basically kind of what you alluded to, daily terrorism, right? Where this is just as in the movie Brazil, where a bomb goes off, they just
yes.
put up a couple of screens and just go about their dinner and pretend nothing's going on, right?
Yes, brilliant,
very applicable to what's happening right now, yes. which is obviously going to give rise, understandably, completely logically, to a fervent kind of nationalism, I believe. How do we go? I mean, and what I'm saying is that reaction to this that's happening might as well be something that's strong enough to topple these globalists at the end of it, if things get chaotic enough. So
yes, and that's why last November, right after Paris attacks, I wrote the Tet Take 2 essay, because if the nationalist part of this equation is to have any chance to survive, the faster they wake up and the sooner they react, the better. The further along this process goes before the correct proper measures are taken, that are going to be very difficult measures. If you wait until car bombs are a daily occasion, ever happening every day in every city, and believe me, that can happen. Daily car bombs, just like Baghdad.
Sure, of course.
Daily, yep. daily. So if you wait till then you're going to have to go into every single Muslim ghetto, like Hama in Syria, and destroy it, because they're not going to go back to the Middle East willingly. I'm talking not only about the refugees from 2015, but I'm talking about third generation Turks. All right. of these people who eventually some countries, and I see this coming, there will be mandatory loyalty oaths where you will eventually, after some much worse acts of terrorism, nobody will listen to the multicultural crowd anymore. The multicultural crowd will be called what they are, which is Quislings. They're Quislings. Instead of bringing in Nazi stormtroopers, they're bringing in jihad stormtroopers. They're Quisling traitors. And nobody will listen to the Quislings when these car bombs are going off every day. And if the countries are going to survive, then there's going to have to be a very strong reaction. And I hope that it doesn't take the form of anything like we saw in the 1930s and 40s in Europe, but certainly it can. And I'm not saying that that National Socialists type of tactics are going to be emerging, but I can imagine that there are going to be big street fights like the 1930s in Berlin versus communist gangs versus Nazi gangs. You know, I can see that. Or a Spanish Civil War situation. I can certainly see Spanish Civil War conditions in Europe, with some areas more tolerant of a continuing Muslim presence and some areas in Balkan-style ethnic cleansing. Coming from Eastern Europe, I can certainly see Poland and Hungary saying, you know why Japan has no terrorism? They have no Muslims.
So I can ethnically homogenous. They have a unified culture and a people which goes back hundreds of years together. You know.
Yes, and among the elected leaders of Europe, you know, there are outsiders who are contending, like Geert Wilders in Netherlands, but in Holland, the president of Holland is saying we need now to resist Brussels. It's almost, in a sense, a parallel to American Civil War before the fighting begins, where in the American Congress, some senator from Georgia is saying we may have to consider seceding from the Union. And we know then the Civil War begins soon after this. This is the stage now in Europe where Hungary and Poland might say, I'm sorry, we're putting up fences, and if you want to do anything about it, you'll have to send soldiers, because our soldiers will have orders that European soldiers can't come in unless they're an ally of ours like Poland.
Well, and what if in that scenario, I've speculated about this before on the program, are you going to fight with these Muslim, you know, invaders, or are you going to join with the forces inside of the nation that want to try to protect and preserve who they are, right?
I think that in Europe, and we're going to see this also in the United States, the Antifas, you know, the ironically and named Antifas, these black, the fascists with the black masks, who seem to love the Islamo-Nazis who carry the black flag. The Antifas also raise the red flag of communism very proudly at their rallies. There's a saying in American English that somebody, this is from boxing, you know, fighting pugilism, that somebody punches above their weight. That means is a stronger fighter than just his weight class should say. Mm-hmm. And the Antifas seem very strong, but what they really have, they are very overrepresented. If you see a demonstration in London or in Holland, then you see nationalists against these Antifas. Well, if you really ask and poll Europeans, I think that 90% are for their nation. Very few would say, oh, yes, I support communism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, Antifa, you know, anti-Islamophobia. Who supports that? Very few people. But what they do is they get out on the street and they appear to be huge. But mm-hmm. they don't represent many people at home watching on television.
No,
this is why
no.
Trump is so popular, or becoming so popular in the USA, because he is unpolitically correct and he is pointing at all of our idols and saying they're all corrupt. And that gets a following. And it's unseen. It was unpredicted. The experts didn't see it coming. The experts denied it was coming. And I think the same thing if in Europe, the context is different. Now, there are many countries with a parliamentary form of government in Europe where you can have a vote of no confidence at any time and throw a government out, depending on each country's laws. But if another attack like this happens, say tomorrow in Germany, and then next week in Madrid, at what point will nations in Europe say, obviously, Brussels has taken us down a dangerous path, and we need to have a national referendum on staying in the European Union, and we also need a vote of confidence in the standing prime minister, et cetera, and throw the government out, because they're not keeping us safe, obviously.
I wonder what at point they actually start classifying this as a civil war, right? Because that's, I mean, it's only when it happens once every day, or is it every week or every month? Or,
well,
you know?
the next stage in this, you can study these. It's, you know, it's fascinating. Even just in the 20th century, you study Argentina, 1970s, Northern Ireland, 1970s, Spain, 1930s. You know, you can go around the world looking at these kind of conflicts, and you can determine that there is a progression. There are some hallmarks, and you can look at these mileposts and say, where are we? The next milepost that we will cross is at the big demonstrations where nationalists come out waving Swedish flag, German flag, are going to go against the Antifas, and then there will be shooting or a bomb will go off. In Calais, they had a march of rioting Muslim immigrants who even spray painted national statues like of de Gaulle,
yeah.
Did vandalism, snuck onto ships. Nobody's arrested. A week later, a French paratrooper general, retired man in his 70s, he's arrested, thrown down to the ground with people just waving the French tricolor. And these countries now are at the point of ignition, where the next time that big crowds, thousands of people, are meeting in the square at the capital city, a bomb is going to go off, or somebody is going to shoot into a crowd, like a 20 or 30 round magazine from a rifle. And then there's going to be stampeding crowds smashing windows of the ethnic group or religious group they don't like. You know, this is what happens when a country tries to keep a boiler from exploding by not permitting any pressure to come out. European countries can have censorship on thought and forced multiculturalism, but eventually we will reach an ignition point. And then these mobs of people that are hurtling towards each other, there's going to be shooting, explosions, and then riots by mobs, destructive riots by mobs. And then I think at that point, it will be recognized as civil war has begun in Europe.
What do you think the governments will offer up here in terms of the promise to keep us safe? Not only them from extremism, you know, Islamic extremism, but so-called, you know, obviously they will classify this rise of healthy nationalism as neo-Nazis and fascists and all the usual name calling that they do to shut down such opposition, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah, Hollande and they are not going to do anything. History is very, very clear on this. Politicians are compromisers. Politicians, what they're used to, how they deal with a crisis, like between a union and an airport over the taxis. They say, okay, this can't go on. It's intolerable. Bring in the head of the taxi union. Bring in the head of the airport management. We're going to sit down and find a compromise. This is how politicians think. And it's the only way they can think. They're incapable of thinking any other way. So when they have bombs going off and people screaming Allah Akbar and shooting in restaurants, they will have the elders from the Islamic community to sit down with the nationalist leaders, and we're going to have a compromise where we're going to agree that women will not be in the swimming pools anymore on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday.
Yep.
This is a compromise.
That's right.
And women should wear a small veil just as a showing that they're not insulting the faith of Islam.
Well, actually, that's not a compromise. That's just us backing up to their point, right?
That's the point I'm making. If you compromise 50% with Sharia, and then 10 years you compromise another 50%, and in 10
years there, then you're there.
Then you're in full Sharia, yep. And you have to pay the dhimmi tax, and you can only practice your faith in a church that was pre-existing. You can't rebuild or repair churches. You know, it will be the complete Sharia.
Yep.
And that's what politicians do. Politicians never say, they'll never say, not Merkel, not Hollande, not Cameron, none of them will say, I've just been wrong. I'm going to come on television and say, my people, I'm shocked. I'm wrong. We have to do something. Now I understand the mortal peril and threat of Islam. They will never say that.
No.
They will call the patriots Nazis, and they will say, we must compromise with our new Muslim countrymen. And
yeah,
compromise
yeah.
is surrender.
You know, I was watching the pundits on CNN today as things were transpiring, and there were security experts, there were weapon experts, there were people who are, you know, geopolitical strategists and all this stuff. And not a single one of these pundits mentioned immigration as the elephant in the room, as the obvious reason for why this is even happening inside of European countries. It's right. remarkable.
It is remarkable because these people are supposedly paid to be make brilliant observations. Last year, we had also a big, vast migration from Mexico and Central America, where they're coming to the border, and it's announced that our border patrol agents are not going to stop you. They're going to lead you to a bus to take you to a refugee center. So you can imagine it's like Merkel making the call for 800,000 to come to Germany. So this is a problem in the news for 2 months. They're covering this migration. Then it fades into the background. Then there is some murder by an illegal alien or gang rapes by illegal aliens. And they never connect it to the big story they were covering only 2 months before.
No, that's right.
And in Europe, they're not putting side by side images of these human parades coming in through Macedonia into Germany. They don't show these human parades on one side of the screen and the terror bomb on the other side of the screen.
Yeah, that's right.
But because even though they don't do it, we do it in our head and on the internet, because we're no longer a slave to these official state propaganda network medias. Now we can use the internet. We can go to Breitbart and websites like that, and from there link to any stories in the world. So the people aren't stupid, and this is why, in spite of all of his many problems, Donald Trump is popular, because he promises to smash the temple.
Yeah. No, that's right. So obviously bombs always get the most attention. Understandable. I mean, it should, right? We should talk about these things, despite the fact that they ignore the root of the problem. But what about this? I don't know if soft targets is the right word, but the daily trickle of, you alluded to it, rapes, groping, robbing, theft, murders, things that have destabilized European and now American society and civilization as well. Trust is non-existent in some areas. No-go zones. There is horrendous treatment of women now. There's even police chiefs in Sweden in certain areas that are urging the women not to go out at night, not to go out alone, be accompanied all the time, etc.
Right. They might as well be handing out a Sharia textbook.
Right. Exactly. And they just don't. They don't talk. It's almost the reverse in this case. It's a cover up of those items in most cases. They don't connect the same dots to that as they do to these bombings, despite the fact that we know that it's the same, same thread here that runs throughout.
Right, because there's a new reality, and the new reality is that we don't only get our images from CNN and the European equivalents. You know, this might have worked in the Soviet Union before, say, the 1970s. You know, even in the Soviet Union, it's very, I found it very interesting that from that generation of Russians, former Soviets, the Beatles were super unbelievable popular band in the USSR in the 1960s and 70s. And the only way to hear this was to smuggle these large black vinyl records into the Soviet Union. And they did. So even without, an internet, the Russians were aware that there was like a youth movement outside and hippies and, modern culture was coming. So you can imagine it's impossible today for the state of any nation to say, this is the only message we want you to hear. Maybe it works in North Korea. It doesn't work in Cuba. Maybe it's working in North Korea only. So we find our own information, and when we find our own information, it just makes us laugh at the official state network. The official state network then becomes like Pravda or Izvestia back in the Soviet Union, something that we joke about. Something that's just a joke.
Well, they're losing an incredible amount of credibility here. There was actually, in fact, just a few days ago, or this past Saturday, there was actually major news, Swedish news media that actually were targeted, hacked, and it was warnings released ahead of time that basically stated, this is what you're getting for all the propaganda that you're releasing to the people. So there's real antagonism. There's real, real anger now against, the mass media. And the fact is, the longer that they grip on to this false reality that they're trying to push on us, the more credibility they lose. And I think that that's a that's ultimately a great thing. It would be not so great if they actually change their story. In this case, people actually go to alternative media, they go to other sources because they know that the reality doesn't actually correspond with the view that they're trying to push on us.
That's right, and they become further and further distanced from their own population, which makes them just the mouthpiece or spokesman of their national regime. You know, which is just a left-wing socialist multi-culti. You know, these same guys that are saying we need to bring in as many Muslim men as possible. I consider them, I have to say it again, they are Quislings. Who can bring in a bunch of Islamo-Nazis? Is it any, maybe it's worse than bringing in German Nazis. I think that even in terms of just, say, the Norwegian example, were there girls that went with German soldiers? I'm sure. But I don't think that German soldiers were going around gang raping Norwegian girls. So maybe in a way, the modern Quislings are even worse than the Norwegian Quisling.
Well, yeah.
Because they're bringing in men, of gangs of men whose game plan, whose modus operandi is to gang rape any girl they can grab.
Yeah.
They know
yeah.
it, and they're bringing them in.
This is a completely different scenario in my view. We've talked, you know, a lot about this on the past. We don't have to get into that now, but what I find, you know, interesting here is basically the fact that, you know, out of this situation, obviously they're hoping for some kind of post-apocalyptic world where there will be peace and rainbows, right? Because even they, as deluded that they are, they can see that, you know, this antagonism and this violence is not going to give them some kind of international socialist utopia. It's going to take a lot of, warfare and battle and bloodshed before that happens. But maybe that's how they seek to play it out, right? That they're seeking to kind of, let's look at what happened, for example, in Bosnia, right? You brought that up, or in the Balkans, that we had a country that rose up. It tried to, in my opinion, protect itself from a conflict that started on a very minor level, much in the same way that we're seeing now. And then what happened is, of course, that the NATO and the US, they joined the Bosnians, they joined the Muslims, and they started, you know, bombing the Christians, basically. And what if that's a scenario that's going to happen here in Europe too? That if and when nationalism takes hold of these countries, the international community is basically going to point fingers and say, well, these countries are now they have concentration camps, they're targeting parts of their own population. It's basically like Assad in Syria. So we have to go in there and take care of business. What's the likelihood of something like that?
I don't think that it's possible. I think that there might be the desire on the part of Brussels, but if Brussels is having a car bomb go off every week, they will have nobody, no soldiers to send to, say, Hungary or Poland at all, because they're going to be so busy saving their own skins. They have no room for going against other European countries that are dealing with the Muslim situation in their own way. But when you bring up the Balkans again, another great, a very significant point from the Balkans is that when you have a two-way, a binary equation, it can be stable, even if you have a lot of anger between the groups. I'll give you an example. For example, in the American South, which, say, was one quarter black, three quarters white, depending on whether you're in this city or that state, but you have a minority black controlled by majority white. It can be stable. I'm not saying just. I'm not saying fair or beautiful, but it's stable. When you have a three-way equation where you constantly have a shifting of alliances as threats are shifting and changing, for example, in the Balkans, with you have Croatian Catholics, Bosnian Muslims, and Serbian Orthodox.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's no stability. You can't have a constant rearranging and of alliances, which means backstabbing and cheating and going behind on one side you're my ally, on this side I'm your enemy. And this is what has been imported into Europe.
Yeah.
We've seen this in big refugee camps. You don't have to wait for white nationalist Germans to come and attack them, okay? Because in the camps, they attack each other.
They rape each other too, yeah.
You have Afghans that hate North Africans.
Yeah.
and you have, you know, Iraqis who hate Libyans fighting without anybody even needing to, you know, to do anything. When you have Shia communities living next to Sunni communities, they're going to fight. And when the bomb goes off outside the police headquarters, what is a very common tactic is you try to get a double benefit. You say, all right, I'm from the Shia faction, I'm against the Sunni faction, but I also hate the police, so I'm gonna put a bomb outside police headquarters, but I will make the false trail to my enemy in the other Islamic community. So our side won't even get the blame. The counter-terrorist police will go into the other neighborhood. So this is the kind of snake pit, you know, full of cobras and rattlesnakes and black mambas. This is what has been imported into Europe. And this is very treasonous to do this. This is not like a big surprise. Like, these are not aliens that came from another planet and they lied to us and said that they were here to serve man. To reference a famous old Twilight Zone episode, it turns out "To Serve Man" is the title of a cookbook.
Yeah, that's right.
The aliens are here to serve man on the dinner plate.
It's that vicious snake that Trump reads in his talks.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. We know better. This isn't new, and we also need to understand that the people, that the politicians, the European politicians who preach tolerance today, will preach Sharia tomorrow.
Mm.
Yeah. This is a proven pattern. I would not be at all surprised in 10 years if Angela Merkel comes out wearing a veil and says, "I was for Islam all along." I'm not saying now that's in her heart today. But if you want to, if your main concern is power, if all you care about is preserving power, one way to do it is for a powerful person to convert after opening the gates. Or somewhere along the process of treason, they make the conversion.
Well, at this rate, too, demographically, they'll be the majority at the end of the century or something like that, right? So by that time, if they just have to appeal to the majority, and at that stage, they can buy the democratic...
Well, no, it won't be the end of the century. That's very optimistic, because
sooner,
you can't go by the absolute majority, like 51% are Muslim compared to 49% Swedish. Ethnic Swedish. It will happen much sooner than that, because the demographic bulge of young men is the only demographic that counts. Girls can't make themselves pregnant, and old people can't be pregnant.
Mm.
So the only, and girls can't fight men. This is realities, okay? It's not like fairy tales, like in our military, you know, with girls in tanks.
Yep, yep.
This is a fairy tale military. But in reality, there are some rules. Old people don't have babies. Girls don't have babies by themselves. So the only people that count are the men under age of 40. And already they're getting in major parts of European cities to being close to 50%. And the cities also have more gravity than the countryside. It doesn't matter if 80% of France is rural population, which is probably too high. So if it doesn't matter if 60% of France does not live in a city. If the 10 major cities are taken over by Muslim factions, that will control the entire country. You know, the countryside can't unite. The individual peasant farmers have no power. The Sharia law will just go from village to village the way it did with the revolution and the guillotines. You take over the cities, you can digest the countryside at leisure.
We'll talk a little bit more later about obviously what we can do here and what recommendations you has in terms of military strategy and things like this. But briefly tell us in the article, the essay, whatever you want to call it, that you wrote, "Tet Take Two: Islam's 2016 European Offensive." You do have a chapter or a point on the Tet Offensive in 1968. Briefly tell us about that if you can, and also how that applies to what's happening today.
The Americans went into Vietnam in large numbers around 1965, had something like 500,000 soldiers in the country. Of them, maybe 100,000 in combat, mostly are logistical and materiel support troops, but it's still a large number of fighters. And by 1968, they are starting to win in South Vietnam against the Viet Cong. And January of 1968, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year was then on January the 30th. It has to do only with the lunar cycle, but it's their new year. There was a declared truce in South Vietnam between American forces, South Vietnamese forces, Viet Cong forces, and Army of North Vietnam then that was in the South. They would have a truce nationwide where people could go home only in South Vietnam for vacation, for holiday. Our CIA, our military intelligence, completely missed the fact that 80,000 Viet Cong had infiltrated into about 50 Vietnamese cities. So they had cached or hidden weapons and ammunition and bombs and, you know, supplies in the cities so that the fighters could just come in on a bus or walking in or come in on a train. And all at the same time, on January 30th, 1968, these 80,000 Viet Cong in the cities attacked targets like the American embassy and other important places, you know, police stations, things like that. The goal, the announced goal, was to trigger a general uprising by all of the South Vietnamese people. This did not happen. The Viet Cong were pretty much wiped out, the 80,000 fighters. But the way that it was portrayed back in America was that it was a huge defeat for America because they had attacked our embassy. It showed that we didn't have control of the country. Actually, after the Tet Offensive, the Viet Cong were a spent force. They never, ever rose again to being what they were before the Tet Offensive when they were wiped out. And in 1975, 3 years after the last American combat troops left in around 72, in 1975, North Vietnamese regular army soldiers, motorized regiments, tanks, trucks, attacked from the north and took over the country, not by guerrilla methods, not Viet Cong, but just a full blitzkrieg invasion, conventional invasion. So the Tet Offensive, you could say, was a failure for the Viet Cong. They did not cause the general uprising of all the people against the Americans. And some people who are very cynical even say that the North Vietnamese knew this would be getting rid of these possibly independent-minded South Vietnamese communists in the Viet Cong, the irregular guerrilla forces, sort of like Stalin waiting outside of Warsaw to rescue it, waiting for the people that had liberated Warsaw to be wiped out by the Germans before they went in. Anyway, be that as it may, I think that we're going to see something similar to that in Europe, not with the precision of a 80,000 man uprising all on a certain day. There's no way it will happen like that. But the forces are already in place. The 80,000 are in Europe, believe me. They're not part of a cohesive unit. There's no brain. There's no central command with people looking at cell phones and getting a secret code on a certain day. But attacks like in Brussels are going to occur more and more frequently, along with knife attacks, shooting attacks, all types of attacks, and they will breed more and more attacks. The more that it happens, the greater the reaction against it by the police. It's going to continue to ratchet up. Meanwhile, Europe will have no visitors this year. There will be no tourism. It will be, you know, a dead zone if this happens. I hope it doesn't. Look, I'm just saying what the theory is.
Sure, yeah.
It could cause an economic catastrophe in Europe, just at a time when the banks are teetering, when the German Bundesbank is completely bankrupt and having big problems, just, you know, with European debt and so forth. If on top of it, all tourism is wiped out, and people can't even go to work because they're afraid to get on the metro because they might get knifed, or blown up, or shot. You know, this will put Europe into a depression. But remember, looking at it, I'm not saying all the members of the European Parliament agree with Matt Bracken. Not at all. A lot of these are just still naive, multicultural, brainwashed idiots.
Yeah, they don't see any of this. They don't live in these neighborhoods. They're very shielded from all of this, you know.
But as you climb up the pyramid towards the people that really have the greatest influence, I think you get more and more the motivation of pure malice and evil. There are people that hate the good. There are people that hate Western civilization. There is nobody that's very intelligent and very educated who doesn't understand that without Western civilization, we wouldn't be living like barbarians. I mean, the Aztecs did not stop human sacrifice on their own. You can say that Spanish colonizers were evil and they took advantage of the Indians. That's all true. But they stopped thousands of people from having their hearts cut out, you know, every month as part of a ceremony.
Yeah.
You know, but there are people that recognizing that what is going to follow the collapse of our civilization is going to be mayhem and a terrible situation, like a 30 years war. We could easily see a situation of a 30 years war again, where you have in those days, you had Protestant versus Catholic, but it became so mixed up. It was very Balkanized because you had papal forces making alliances with certain Protestants. It went on and on. It wasn't just strictly ideologically or religiously based. It becomes a multi-faction, almost like a Europe of warlords. And I think that's what we could see in Europe coming forward. A Europe of warlords.
Exactly. There are quite a few leftists and cultural Marxists that, just watching the initial reactions, they're definitely more concerned with the reaction to these bombings by nationalists and those who, in their view, then are seeking to use this, right? That somehow... I even saw some people that were talking about the fact that it's our fault that we haven't integrated these people properly. They're literally, turning it right back on the Belgian apparatus and even the Belgian people that somehow, this is just because they're not integrated. It's remarkable the excuses they make for these people that they wouldn't do for any others.
Yeah, these excuse makers, the longer they hold on to that, the further out they become where they will be aligned with the Islamic terrorists themselves.
That's right.
Because you can't, there's a saying in the United States, don't pee on my head and tell me it's raining. Okay.
Yeah.
It's obvious when every time this happens, somebody is yelling Allah Akbar right before the bomb goes off. Don't tell us it has nothing to do with Islam. So the people who are, as a profession, making excuses for Islam, and the first reaction is, we must fear a backlash against our poor Muslims. That's their first reaction, not how can we stop more Muslim bombs from exploding. Their first reaction is, this might be misused by right-wing extreme nationalists. their fear is a Hitler boogeyman rising, and right in front of them is somebody else waving a black flag. That's just as bad as Hitler.
Yeah. Well, let's definitely dive deeper into how you see this playing out and what can be done about this in the second segment. But before we go into that and take a short break here on that, let's just talk for a moment because we really didn't detail that yet. You're the author of Enemies Foreign and Domestic. Tell us more about the book and why you wrote that and how it kind of fits into what we're talking about here.
Well, I wrote the book in around 2000, 2001, actually before the 9/11 situation in New York City. But this is something we touched on before before we started recording. An advantage of self-publishing and modern media is that an author can take a book and make major changes to it only, in a very short time span, unlike going to a printing house where your book gets put into a queue where it will be published in 18 months. If I had written a book that didn't mention 9/11 and the book comes out after 9/11, the book is obsolete. So I'm able to, using self-publishing, have a much more timely, topical book. And at the time, and still ongoing today, I'm very concerned in the United States with our own country becoming much more of a police state. It doesn't matter who causes a terrorist accident, we all lose more freedom every time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The police get more weapons, more armor, more tanks. more permission for spying and eavesdropping. And then you have this nexus with the media where the state sympathetic or state even controlled media, because so many of them are related, so many of the owners of these networks are related to, you know, high politicians and so forth. It's very incestuous. I'm sure it's not different in Sweden.
No, same.
But yeah, but I wanted to write a book from the point of view of people who understand that we are being lied to. So in the book, the media tell fabulous lies about events that people understand in a completely different way. The book begins with a terrorism act at a stadium, which is blamed on a right-wing, reactionary militia type of guy. And he's a patsy. He's just put there with a rifle near a stadium. But the real shooting is done by somebody who actually, wants the part of our government that deals with right-wing terrorists. He wants their budget increased. He wants his own private bureaucracy to be expanded. This is after 9/11, and he has seen the FBI's budget increase 10 times to fight international terrorism. But this guy's directorate is for, the nationalists, the militia types, the right wingers, and his budget is not going up. So he decides to instigate a false act, blaming it on right wingers, and then instigating kind of a civil war within the United States over our Second Amendment, which has to do with firearms. Anyway, that was my first novel in back around 2002 it came out. But my books, I've always tried to keep them grounded in reality. They're not like Tom Cruise action movies. People don't speak 10 languages and act like James Bond all the time. I try to keep them, grounded in the real world and not, fantasy thriller fiction, which I think is an advantage of them. But, it gives me a chance to kind of stretch my legs and share my vision of some trends that I see.
So it's seeking to kind of get out that a message that's to a certain extent a little bit of prophetic of what you can see. Yeah.
Yes, this is what's coming.
Right.
This is what's coming, and these are some things we should watch out for. When you see this, it means that we're a further step down the down the progression. That this is not all. Don't just be surprised every time. Like this just came out of from left field from a blue sky. That these are things that are happening for a reason. And also, I think the book, not to pat myself on the back, but the basic premise of my first novel is what you would today call a false flag operation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where the true shooter is exactly opposite of the patsy shooter that is meant to take the blame. And I just want people to kind of be aware when the media presents a story, look behind it and look at the true motives of people. Did that media presentation of a news event, is it realistic or is it just some, is it part of a media package for selling a false narrative? Benghazi, things like this also mm-hmm. being examples of, depending on the politics of who's making the announcement. They're basically just selling a narrative, and people need to look for their own evidence.
All right, very good. We have so much more to talk about. It feels like we're just kind of getting started here, but I want people to check out enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. That's your main website, and of course you have, how many books in the series is it now, 3 or 4?
Well, there's 3 that are a trilogy, and they're finished. I'm not going to write any more with those characters or situations. And I have another standalone book, and I'm writing another standalone book. And I have a lot of essays on my website. I've written these novels, but it's much more important these times to read my essays. My novels are very long. Not too many people have time to read long novels, but I have a lot of essays linked on my website. I would suggest people can look there for some of my other ideas, what I think is coming up in the years ahead.
All right, very good. Much more coming up here, folks. We're going to continue to talk more with Matt after the break and talk about what kind of future we are actually looking at with more attacks like those we see in Brussels, which is unfolding now. We're learning more and more as we go here as well of who's behind it and whatnot. Obviously, Islamic State did take, claimed responsibility for it. But I'll also ask Matt what we can do in terms of fighting back and how to organize and strategize, etc. But yeah, definitely check out the website, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with Matt Brackett.